Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting founder, you know, a founder that has done it a couple of times, you know, I would say. And, you know, the building, the scaling, the financing, the exiting. So all the things, you know, that we like to hear, you know, in this show. You know, also we're going to be hearing what he's up to with his latest baby, you know, which is quite a rocket ship, you know, that he has been pushing now for 9 years. But really exciting and inspiring conversation ahead of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Wayne Slavin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Lovely intro. Happy to be here.
So originally from outside of the US, South Africa, but obviously you came, you ended up coming here, you know, to Southern California, San Diego, and then the rest is history. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, life growing up was something that I think probably tough to replicate these days, but it seemed like an amazing time, coming with an immigrant family to the States into Southern California in the late 80s, a time where I think anything was possible. It feels like that was, in hindsight, how the world looked from a place like San Diego in the early 80s. You know, the freeways were empty. I remember being told stories about how the freeways were so empty that the cars would gather together because it was too lonely to be on the freeways by yourself. And, you know, here we are 30 years later and wow, how things have changed and progressed. But very blessed to have ended up in a place like that and grateful for my family for having brought me out of Africa, quite literally, to the States and let me pursue my dreams.
You know, how do you think it has shaped you up to have immigrant parents, you know, to come here, you know, with nothing, build a better, you know, future for the family? How do you think that has shaped you up?
I think the key there is sharing stories, sharing knowledge, sharing perspective of each generation getting to a different place and having an appreciation for the generation before was just awesome. And the work ethic was also really touching, reflecting a couple of years ago during COVID as a parent, now as a parent of young kids, really thinking about where the next 30 years are going to be, that we're like the 30 years I, you know, really enjoyed in California before I made my way around the States. And reflecting on that moment and how, you know, the stories repeat in people's lives, generation after generation, and picking my family up and leaving California and going to, you know, Texas in this case during COVID. But really having that appreciation for, let's say, the grit and the bravery to just pick up from a place where you quite literally had to leave everything behind. It's hard for us to imagine these days, but it was a country that people were leaving and you actually had to leave your stuff. You couldn't just book a flight on Delta, put your stuff in a bag and just go. You actually had to leave things that you wanted to bring with you. You had to leave them and start quite literally fresh. And that grit, I think, is just embedded in your DNA after you see your parents go through it.
So in your case, you ended up getting your undergrad in San Diego, then you got your grad in New York City, actually in Columbia. But it sounds like management, you know, it's all over, whether it's technology management, you know, but management, you know, seems to be like something that you really were going for. So why management?
Yeah. There's people who love to go deep. They figure out what they love and they go deep, but they want to go deep in the area that they're already passionate about. And they go academically deep as well. And then there's folks who go after the thing that, like, that is not their sweet spot by default. And so I grew up in tech my entire life, right? It started with DOS and dial-up and bulletin boards and literally breaking the computer every day. My dad would have to fix it. My older brother would have to fix it. And I would break it from like 3 years old. And eventually, I started to fix the computer for other people, for my parents, et cetera. And so the tech part came easy for me. And maybe naively believed that like the best product would win. It didn't matter. All the other stuff didn't matter. It was like a tech beauty, perfection purist, right? If you built the best product, you would win. And as I'd built early businesses, early experiments, early ways of trying to make money on the internet in like pre-2000, it became clear that that wasn't the case. And so I think always knew that the piece that would be hard, because it just wasn't a natural skill, would be how to build and scale a company and a team and a culture. And so rather than go get a degree in the thing that I already knew how to do and had been doing for 20 years, why not go to that other thing that is, I think, more art than science and more situational than actually data-driven and empirical, which is code, product, things working together. People don't always behave rationally. Systems don't always congregate around the most efficient solution. Maybe over millions and hundreds of millions of years, you could argue an organism does that, but companies don't usually live that long. And so what are the things that you could learn about managing that more effectively? And so didn't see the need to like go get a stamp of approval for technology when, as an undergrad, it's a funny side story here, as an undergrad, you had to pass a mandatory technology course, went to the professor and said, hey, after the first class, hey, going to come visit you during office hours. And the office hours was probably a little cocky about it, but said literally, either I'm going to disrupt the class and correct you every time you make a mistake, or I just want to show up and take the final. And he said, no, what we can do though is you could teach a class. I will let you take one of the semester classes and teach the whole class something, and decided to do that. And it was funny, as a undergrad, was waking up at 7:30 a.m. to take classes, leaving by lunch to go to my day job, which was like running a data center for a big startup in San Diego. And so didn't see the need to like get the stamp of approval that I could do tech. It was always there.
So then talk to us about venturing into the world of entrepreneurship.
I'd say the spark started pretty simply. And I do think about this a lot these days as a parent. How do you instill this in kids? And I'm sure lots of your listeners think about this too and read books on how to, you know, motivate your kids, et cetera. But I think my parents, as entrepreneurs, really just maybe by accident, maybe intentionally, just told me, if you want something, you got to go figure out how to do it, how to get it, and just go figure it out. And then the beauty of, I think, that moment in time was they just then let me go figure it out. So if I wanted a, you know, landline phone in my bedroom, or I wanted a TV in my bedroom, I had to go figure it out. And it was a moment in time. You could figure out how to make money on the internet. There was lots of innovative ways to do that. And it was before everything was commoditized and we all had Shopify and WordPress and all these awesome tools. And so there was a moat, there was a barrier to entry, but it was just a question of, you know, time and your dedication to figure stuff out. And so I think my parents just said, you can have anything, you just got to go figure out how to get it. And that was really the journey. And, you know, I'd argue there was maybe too much imposter syndrome, because it was like, wait, that actually worked. Why not go do it more, do it bigger, do it larger? But it was always with, you know, big dose of skepticism of, will this work? In hindsight, many of them worked and probably could have been even more successful if we had poured gas on it. And that ties back also to why management? How do you know that something's working? When do you know to pour gas on it? It's not always obvious when you live and breathe it and eat it and, you know, that's your whole day. Sometimes you don't know when it's actually working.
So in your case, you know, you actually ended up going to grad school. But one thing that is very interesting here is you go to grad school and then you go back into joining other teams, into joining more like the corporate side of things. Because one thing that is striking me is before grad school, you actually built a couple of companies. And in fact, you even sold one, you know, essentially. So once you've seen the full cycle of building, scaling, financing, and exiting, I mean, why going to corporate versus, you know, going at it again?
Yeah, my early startups were all bootstrapped. Back to that immigrant mindset, I think being in Southern California might have been different if I was in Northern California around the world of venture. Southern California VC, I think, is still not taken hold, right? It's still not part of the culture. It's a great place to live, and in remote world, you have venture-backed companies that have people all over. But at that time, that was a foreign concept. And so everything was built, bootstrapped, tied together with, you know, shoelaces and duct tape and, you know, the skin of an avocado in San Diego. Like, that's what everything was held together by. And they happened to work, because what other way was there? That was the only disciplined way to build a company, was to bootstrap it and make it profitable. And so the first company helped cash flow and bootstrap the second, going from an ad-driven revenue model, which is unpredictable. You know, Google is the overlord of that. They control your clicks, and they control your top of funnel, and they control the cost per click. And that was it. And that wasn't a comfortable place for me to be, because you couldn't control your own destiny, which has really been a theme throughout my life and throughout companies and the culture of the company, controlling your own destiny. And moving from that business model into a SaaS model. And at that time, there was no SaaSter, and it wasn't even called SaaS. It was just like, how can you get people to pay you monthly so that you wake up on the first and you don't have to start from zero? You start from some baseline. And built a company, scaled it to a point. But like I said earlier, you don't necessarily know when to pour gas on, and nor do you know how. And so built a company to the point at which, you know, I reached my ceiling for that moment in time, and decided, hey, I built it. It worked. We, you know, our retention numbers in hindsight were elite retention numbers for a SaaS company, and our NRR was elite company status, but it just wasn't known, right? The history hadn't happened yet. And so I said, well, this is a linear growth business. Things were starting to go viral. If you remember in the early, you know, early 2000s, that was like this whole idea of things going viral, a J curve, a rocket ship. And I was like, but that's not what's happening here. This is like, put money into marketing and it grows and it compounds linearly. And so I actually thought that there was something I was missing. And maybe I wasn't missing it. Maybe I pulled the ripcord too early, but decided, hey, I want to go where somebody understands outside capital and how do you pour fuel on this thing? And so decided to go to grad school in New York. Could have gone to the Bay Area, but decided to go to New York to get a change of pace. And the reason I went to the program I went to was that there were only about 20 people accepted to the program. I think they made a mistake on, you know, my application. Maybe they just hit the wrong button, but the system didn't allow them to undo it. But I showed up on the first day, and the reason I wanted to go there was that they matched every student with like a sitting Fortune 500 CIO or CTO of a big company, whether it was a bank, private equity, et cetera. And I said, I want to be around a mentor who knows that world of, you know, venture, outside capital, et cetera. And so tailored kind of my work and my thesis work and my coursework around really attracting that mentor and ended up successfully doing that with an awesome venture investor who's still to this day on our board. And that's where I said, hey, I want to do two things in parallel. I want to go to school to learn how to be a better manager. I want to find someone who knows this thing I don't know about. And instead of learning by failing, I just want somebody who's done it to explain it to me and successfully did that. And then said, well, I've always done two things at once. I've studied and worked or worked two things in parallel. And so didn't want to be working on my own gig, wanted to learn from others. And so joined, initially a big company trying to go online and struggling with it. And then later on, a scaling SaaS startup, one of the biggest successes in New York tech history. And I think actually all three of those things have helped me to level up. Watching great managers, watching terrible managers, watching politics, watching aligning incentives, and just learning as well academically. I think it all plays together in a symphony.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. There's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
What do you think obviously incredible companies, that you were alluding to. One that got sold, which was Barnes & Noble Digital. It was part of that. Then Buddy Media, which got acquired by Salesforce. That was actually an incredible exit. And then also Taplingo, that was acquired by Grubhub. So, obviously this is incredible experiences that you were achieving and putting under your belt. I guess, what do you think needed to happen for you to be okay with the idea of going at it, again, as a founder?
Yeah, I want to say that the we'll get to, the start of Sure and how we, came up with the idea for it here in a minute. But I'd say the thing that gave me the confidence, honestly, was came up with the idea and laughed about it. I thought it was hilarious. Like, this was actually a joke of, wouldn't it be funny if XYZ was possible? And just couldn't get it out of my head. And, when it started Sure, this was like peak VCs subsidizing Uber. Ubers across San Francisco were like $2.25. It was like any idea you could throw at the wall, you'd probably be able to go build it, right? And at least raise some seed capital. And really waited for that thing that just got under my skin and just couldn't put it down, and waited for, the confirmation on a long weekend that, hey, I'm going to go build this thing and see if it works. And if it doesn't work, okay. But at this point, I can't ignore it anymore. That was the moment.
So when you realized I can't ignore this any longer, what happened next?
Well, I'll back up a sec if I could. So I'll give some context. Had gone through consumer electronics business, gone through an enterprise software business, then into a payments business. And, payments I thought was perfectly challenging, great company, moment in time of how are we going to do food ordering, mobile payments on closed ecosystems. And we had done an amazing job, changed college campuses, changed the world of ordering food. And actually, Topingo, where I was the VP of product before starting Shure, we ended up being TechCrunch's most innovative company of 2013. And nobody had ever heard of us. But this was ahead of Snapchat, Amazon, Tesla, all these companies. And it was like, this little company in San Francisco is actually doing amazing stuff. And I think that was always an important thing of fighting above your weight class, right? Just because you didn't raise the most capital, just because you didn't have a name everyone knew, just because you were under the hood rather than the brand, didn't mean you couldn't do awesome things. And so I thought, coming out of that experience, that nothing can be harder than what we were doing. Like, it was just so difficult, from hardware to software to the adoption curve of mobile to, iPads having LTE versus just Wi-Fi. Like, we were dealing with so many interesting problems. And then on the enterprise side, dealing with huge institutions, not just, payment and money movement, but selling into quite literally governments and universities, and like how challenging that is, and people who want to control their own areas. And I thought, nothing can be harder than this. This, like, anything will be less complex than this. And boy, was I wrong. But basically, I was on flight to Las Vegas. And I think you come up with ideas in a couple of good places. One, in bathrooms. If you're in the bathroom, maybe you're taking a shower, maybe you're doing something else. I think you come up with some good ideas there. And I think you come up with good ideas. You got nothing else to do. These days you have a lot of distractions, but on a flight. And I was on a flight to Vegas, and I saw the people sitting next to me gripping the handrests because we were in a little bit of turbulence. And they were, super scared. It is scary. But then took a step back and said, this is one of the safest places you can be. It's much safer than riding a bike or taking a car trip. This is super safe. And I said, we do hundreds of millions of mobile transactions a year. Like, this is what we're really good at. And at that moment, I said, I wonder if I could sell these people life insurance before we took off. They're so scared right now. I wonder if we could contextually target them and say, hey, you're about to get on a flight from Baltimore to Miami. Amazing. Why don't you buy life insurance right now? And that was like the kernel of inspiration. And I actually stood up on the plane and asked three rows ahead of me and three rows behind me, hey, if before we took off, you could buy life insurance for 99 cents, would you buy it? And everybody, obviously, they were scared at that moment. Their heart rate was, 150, said, hey, how could I not buy it? And again, like I said a minute ago, I thought it was hilarious. I'm like, wow, that was just so funny. What a funny observation. Okay, back to selling smoothies on college campuses through a mobile app. And it took about a year of just joking about it and laughing about it to really build a prototype. And that prototype was really approached blank slate. I knew nothing about insurance, knew about e-commerce, knew about contextual commerce, and said, hey, I wonder if people are going to buy $50,000 of insurance, $5 million of insurance. Are they going to spend 99 cents? Are they going to spend 20 bucks? I had no idea. But built the entire flow, if you will, to go through purchasing quote unquote life insurance. And it was purely a test. Trafficked it with ads and had a few hypotheses that I wanted to prove. I wanted to see if people would buy it a week in advance or 5 hours in advance, or if they were going to buy it for just the one trip or their round trip, a few different things. So needed to figure out price and product mix, needed to figure out some data about when they're going to buy it. because there's, you know, insurance is sold to people, or maybe there was going to be a change where people would buy it if they could buy it right now. And ended up testing that mix and having a conversion rate at its best converting offerings of 15.91%. And I said, wow, Jeff Bezos would be jealous of click to buy of 16%. I have to build this business. Like at that point, that was the moment where I was like, okay, now I have to build it. Like it worked. I thought it was a joke. I thought it was funny. I thought I could spend a weekend testing it out. And then some confirmation. Now you got to go build it. But still knew nothing about insurance. I mean, all of it was just hypothetical, from the name to the landing pages to what information was needed. And then said, okay, well, I can't be the first person to have wanted to start something in insurance. Go do some research. Find an article about a guy who tried to start a life insurance company. And the article was titled something very inspirational, "The Startup from Hell," quite literally. And it was a story about a guy who went and tried to start a life insurance company after after a moment in his life. And it didn't go so well. And I said, whoa, okay, he obviously learned some things. Another theme in my life, I like to learn from other people rather than fail at it. And so reached out to him and said, hey man, I read the article. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I want to know if I'm an idiot and if I'm wasting my time in insurance. And he responded back and said, too early to know if you're an idiot, but you're not wasting your time in insurance. Let's get on a call. And that was kind of my first introduction to anybody that knew anything about insurance. He ended up running a large life insurance company years later. And I went on to start Sure. And it was based off of that idea that, like, eventually insurance was going to come online, and didn't know how we would get it there. But, you know, that's kind of part two of the story.
So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Sure? How do you guys make money?
So change over time is more of an evolution than a hard pivot. I think people fantasize about this idea of pivoting. I mean, it's amazing that Slack was a pivot. So there's some other amazing pivot stories. We don't have a pivot story per se. We originally started out with a mobile app to sell lots of different types of insurance through one interface. So, hey, I can open this up, not unlike I'm going to go to DoorDash and I see every restaurant. Okay, I'm going to open up this app and I'm going to see every type of insurance. I'm going to be able to buy it right now. I don't need to re-enter my information. I don't need to do anything. It's just automatic. And it turned out management, all those degrees didn't teach you anything about marketing. So customer acquisition is not the sweet spot. LTV to CAC ratios that are crazy don't make me sleep well at night. And so eventually we went through this process. I went through the process of going and seeing the C-suite of many major insurance companies in the US. And we had a pretty simple conversation. The conversation was, hey, we want to sell your product through our mobile app. It didn't matter if it was home insurance or pet insurance or travel insurance. We want to sell your product. Cool. Here's the demo. The demo took 30 seconds. That was kind of the point, is that it took 30 seconds to buy it. And then we would spend the remaining part of that meeting that I had to travel across the country to go do for, you know, 1 hour, spending multiple days on the road to go do, spend the rest of the time showing them what we had built that ran the business, really the back end. And the first part of the demo would go great. They'd be like, okay, yeah, you could sell our insurance product through your app. No problem. We love that. But show us how you do that thing. Show us that system that you were running your operation off of. And that's when they would start calling people into the room. Like literally being like, hold on, let me go get so-and-so. He needs to see this, or she needs to see this. And I mean, I'm pretty slow on the pickup. And it took about six of those meetings going exactly the same way for me to realize, actually, that's the thing. Like like we're really good at building enterprise software. The distribution piece and the customer acquisition piece, it's just not the sweet spot for us. And so really evolved the business to be much more enterprise focused, infrastructure focused. And that worked out well with kind of the how the insure tech market unfolded, going from insurance companies that were trying to bring technology to where we are today. And I would call the first part of that InsurTech 1.0 to where we are today, which is thriving, burgeoning, it's called InsurTech 2.0, really focused on software, infrastructure, and rails. And that's really been the unfolding of the business and what we do. And so in summary, we really provide the SaaS infrastructure and solution today at Sure to run an end-to-end insurance program.
Obviously, you know, like this is capital intensive, you know, as I'm listening, the infrastructure that you guys have built and what you have accomplished is really remarkable. I guess for the capital side of it, how much capital have you guys raised to date and what has been the experience of going through the cycles there?
We've raised to date, I call us a pre-IPO company because IPO market hasn't really opened up yet. But we've raised through our Series C, which we raised in 2021. And we've raised about $123 million in venture capital from traditional VCs and corporate venture as well. So corporates that are in our space, that understand our space. And kind of did it in the normal way, right? A lot of meetings with VCs, lots of pitches, and finding our way, but always knew that I wanted to, rather than make fundraising the thing that we're the best in the world at, always knew that that's just the means to an end. And just because you raise the money doesn't mean you have to spend the money, and wanted to control our own destiny. And so even though we had raised our Series B and we're profitable as a startup before it was cool to be profitable. People used to say, why would you want to do that? And here we are 4 years later, and people are like, the only thing they care about is, are you profitable? Go speak to any VC who you meet on a daily basis. And they're like, that's all we care about. But 4 years ago, they laughed. They were like, what? Why would you want to be profitable? And so we built that muscle, tying back all the way to, you know, immigrant bootstrapped origins. We knew how to do it. And when we raised our Series C, we raised $100 million from some awesome investors. When we did that, we had every dollar of our Series B still in the bank. And that, I'd say, capital efficiency, that attention to when is the time to scale, when is the time to grow, really allowed us to navigate this turbulent past 4 years of COVID, furloughs, layoffs, profitability, ventures drying up, deals and valuations and structure and term. And I think that that's just a contrarian way of building a company, and you can do it even with traditional sources of capital. And so that's really been the experience to date. And we're in a fortunate place where we don't need to raise money. And can just continue to build.
You get to control your own destiny, which is beautiful. Now, obviously, with investment, you know, comes also betting on a vision. So as we're thinking about that, Wayne, if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Sure is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Yeah, the vision of Sure starts off as something that people will think is just a crazy statement. And that crazy statement is really that today, if you trust McKinsey data, but also our real world experience running billion-dollar insurance programs, is that 1%, give or take, of insurance transactions are truly online, meaning there's no human involved. This is not my pivot to AI, believe me. It's more to say that even today in 2024, the internet's been mass adoption curve since 1995. Like, this has been happening for a long time. There's a human involved in 99% of the transactions. And that could be an agent. That could be somebody who shows up at your house to look at your roof or your pool or your fence. That could be somebody who is just entering information from one system to another because they never automated it, or down to a claim, somebody getting involved there. And so if we're at like 1% is truly online, we're actually pretty parallel to the moment in time when credit cards started emerging in the early 60s, where prior to that, everything was cash and check. Like there was no other way to make a payment. But there were a few people, a few companies that made a bet. MasterCard and Visa come to mind, that cashless transactions were going to be the thing that dominated commerce. And it took a really long time, right? I'm sure you can remember being in New York City not that long ago where you couldn't pay for your taxi cab with a credit card. Like it went industry by industry, business by business, accepting credit cards. And here we are today. You go out for lunch on your break, and there are places you can't even use cash anymore. It literally says on the door, we are cashless. And so people get wrong what will change in 1 year. They overestimate what's going to happen. It's a venture problem, right? They think in 1 year, this whole thing's going to be solved. And they underestimate what's going to change in 10 years. And if you have a 10-year mindset, the vision of what we're doing at Shure is, yes, we've built a ton of technology infrastructure that required capital and investment and, you know, pragmatism to do. But what we're building is really the Visa of insurance and the rails to bring insurance transactions online between two constituents. And I'll give it to you this way. In the world of Visa and MasterCard, they're the network. I'm going to simplify this. I know there's a lot of fintech nerds and they're going to yell at me in the comments, and that's fine. But in this simplified network, right, you've got issuing banks, underwriting and lending, and you've got merchants who are the distribution. In what we're building in our rails, insurance companies are underwriting and in essence issuing policies. And what we're doing is enabling a new set of distribution, global Fortune 10, Fortune 500 consumer brands that don't sell insurance today to sell insurance. So we've helped the world's largest EV manufacturer launch their auto insurance business. We run the auto insurance, digital and auto insurance business for the largest car manufacturer, Toyota. We do the same thing for small business insurance with companies like QuickBooks and MasterCard and folks like Revolut and MoneyLion. These are companies who have millions, if not billions, of consumers that they have nailed their first act. They get their product. People love their product. They use their product all the time. And they're looking for how can we expand our LTV? How can we drive more revenue from our customer base? And they naturally arrive at, what about insurance? And it's just really hard because the insurance companies never built the technology. These consumer or B2B companies aren't going to learn insurance. And that's the same way. Every merchant is not going to integrate to every bank, and every bank is not going to build their own merchant network. They're going to use an independent. So you talk about the vision. The vision we have is not to build an enterprise software company. The vision we have is that if we're at 1% adoption of insurance is truly online today, by 2030, we want to be 9% of insurance transactions. And behind payments, insurance is the biggest dollar value in the biggest TAM in fintech. So there's about $6 trillion. Some people think it's double that, okay? $6 trillion of insurance dollars to play with. We want to bring the next 9, 10% online in the next 5 years. And right now, we're doing it. We're already running billion-dollar insurance programs through our rails.
I love it. So Wayne, for the people that are inspired, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Certainly hit me up on X, can shoot me an email. It's my name at our domainname.com. Happy to respond and be helpful where I can and give advice. If it's worth anything, feel free to not listen to it.
Amazing. Well, hey, Wayne, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.